For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Diane Jeffrey discusses her taut thriller, The Guilty Mother, and her novel approach to research.
When I'm planning a book, either I drag my family on holiday to the place where I want to set the book, or I bring over my school kids because I'm a school teacher.
Narrator John Cormack reveals his own surprising backstory.
Yes, I was the voice of Gerry Adams for Channel 4 News. Oh, it was mad. It was just stupid.
Lynn Livingston walks us through the winter wonderland of Christmas books in the RNIB library, and we find out more about that Yuletide icon, the Robin.
Because Robin is actually the nickname. Redbreast was the original name. And in fact, there's a name even older than that, Ruddock.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Diane Jeffrey's debut novel, Those Who Lie, spent weeks as a Kindle bestseller. Her latest, The Guilty Mother, is an equally gripping psychological thriller that's one of the Daily Mirror's top 10 audiobooks of 2019. Diane joined me in the studio to tell me more. Take us into the world of The Guilty Mother.
So The Guilty Mother is the story of Melissa Slade, whose twin baby girls died in suspicious circumstances 5 years previously, and she's currently serving a life sentence in prison for murder. But new evidence has recently come to light, and her loved ones hope that she'll be freed thanks to this evidence. It's also the story of Jonathan Hunt, a journalist. His boss wants him to investigate the Melissa Slade case and get to the truth before the date of the appeal. And he has his own reasons for not wanting anything to do with Melissa Slade, but his colleague, Kelly Fox, a junior reporter, is fascinated with Melissa Slade and encourages him and helps him with his investigation. And together they have to answer the questions that I'm hoping the readers are asking themselves too, which are, is Melissa innocent or guilty? And if this is a miscarriage of justice and she is innocent, then what really happened to the two baby girls?
Well, it kept me guessing pretty much to the last page. And it's all encapsulated in the title, isn't it? The Guilty Mother could apply to her guilt for a crime that she actually might have committed, or the sense of guilt, the burden that she carries with her for allowing her two children to die. It's a very nuanced problem.
I think the title that they finally came up with really fits the book. Mm. Originally, it was entitled The Appeal, and it wasn't doing very well in the pre-sales, and so my editor decided that they wanted a change of title because everybody loved the cover, and the cover's got a sort of eerie blue cot with a bright orange blanket and quite stark contrasts and warm and cold, and it's a great cover. The designer did a terrific job. So they decided to change the title instead and proposed a whole load of titles that I vetoed, and then came up with The Guilty Mother. And when my editor said, what about The Guilty Mother, she really wasn't sure about it, and I thought, yes, it's perfect. And as you said, it's the whole question, isn't it, of did she or didn't she? And she is guilty anyway, because she's feeling guilty all the time about failing her children and feels responsible for what happened to them, although we don't really know why and the full extent of her responsibility.
And that actually makes her appear guilty to other people, the fact that she's beating herself up, that she doesn't want to revisit the pain of bereavement by going through an appeal, and also having to go through the process of her children being alive and then being dead again in front of a jury is too painful for her to want to revisit.
That's right. Yes, she was a difficult character to write because I needed her to come over as feeling guilty, although we don't really know why. But I also sort of needed characters to root for her a little bit and to want to know what happened to her, to like her enough to want to know what happened. And at the same time, her voice comes through diary entries, essentially, until the chapter where she actually meets the journalist. So she was quite difficult to write. I was aware that I was in danger of creating a very unsympathetic character because she can't give too much away one way or the other. And so it was quite hard to make her likeable enough for us to want to know what happened to her. I struggled with that a little bit. And on the other hand, Jonathan, who I thought I was going to have difficulty with, partly because he's a male, and so I had to get myself into the head of a male character, I warmed to him immediately and he just took off.
Yeah, he's a very sympathetic character, and I suppose he represents a lot of the self-doubt that a reader's going to have about approaching a case where a woman has been convicted of probably the most terrible thing that could ever happen to a parent, losing a child. And is she the monster, or is she a victim of a miscarriage of justice? He would prefer, like many of us, not to look too closely.
Absolutely. And also, he's a single father, cutting corners everywhere at work and with bringing up his children, but he just does his best. And he doesn't want to go anywhere near this case for reasons of his own, which have to do with his own fatherhood.
And it's further complicated by the fact that Melissa is a former police officer who, because of that job, must believe in the correctness of the justice system.
Yes, she feels that the justice system has failed her, and then she does believe in justice through the justice system. She also has a cellmate who has been failed by the justice system. And the fact that she was a police officer means that she gets treated particularly badly in prison, as women who have been accused of killing their children do anyway. But this makes it even more complicated for her. And then her ex-husband, who's a police officer as well, this gives him, I think, access to the investigation and material that he can use for her appeal.
Were you inspired by real-life cases, such as those of Sally Clark and Angela Canning?
Yes, absolutely. That was the original trigger for the idea that I had. I was still in England during the 90s and the noughties when several women were convicted on the basis of so-called expert testimony, where they said that basically if their children had died, statistically, it couldn't possibly be cot death. And this is really where the idea sprang from for this particular story, although it doesn't have anything to do with their case at all, but this is where the idea came from, yes, very much. So I was extremely moved by what happened to these women and how their lives were upended by what happened to them even after they were freed.
And were there any books in particular that inspired you to begin writing psychological thrillers?
The book that made me want to write psychological thrillers was Into the Darkest Corner by Elizabeth Haynes, which I think is just a fantastic book and an exemplary in the genre of psychological suspense. And recently I was very, very impressed by Our House by Louise Candlish, which I've been recommending to everybody. She won the 2019 Crime and Thriller Book of the Year at the British Book Awards, and I thought that her Our House was just very original and brilliantly written. I loved it.
You really do investigate the nature of coincidence. Whilst it's a serious subject, you clearly actually had quite a bit of fun with the nature of coincidence whilst writing the book as well.
Yes, I like coincidences and I like parallels. So Jonathan has parallels with Melissa. He can very much see himself in her, which both fascinates him and repels him because he doesn't want to be like her. One of the coincidences came from my writing buddy, another author, Amanda Brittany, who, when I got stuck with my manuscript, said to me, "Why don't you do this?" And I immediately dismissed her idea as being so far-fetched it just wasn't feasible at all, and slept on it and got up the next day and thought, "Oh yes, I could do that." But yes, it's a huge coincidence.
Obviously, the other side of coincidence is manipulation, and the book keeps you guessing all the way through. Is Jonathan being manipulated in being told to investigate something that he really doesn't want to? Are people trying to manipulate the investigation and the possible retrial? It's very tightly plotted. Do you sit down with a tight plot beforehand, or do you let the book explore itself as you write it?
The question of whether we're plotters or pantsers, I plot to a large extent. That said, my second book, I really winged it, but I think it was more linear. This book was a little bit harder in that I'm messing around with two time frames and three points of view, and so to a large extent it had to be plotted. When I first came up with the idea, I pitched it to my editor and she was very enthusiastic about it, but then I left it and wrote to my second book instead. I just felt that I was going to be out of my comfort zone with it. So it did take a lot of plotting, but that said, I plan it ahead as far as I possibly can, but a lot of it comes to me while I'm actually writing, and I'll change a lot of it while I'm actually writing. And in fact, all the twists were in place before I started writing, except for what is probably the main one, which happens right in the epilogue, which came to me about halfway through. And I thought, oh yes, that's it. And so put that one in as well. So it is largely plotted, but I think that you can't be too rigid with it. And one of the things that when I plotted it originally, I didn't even have Kelly in there, and she actually gets a voice of her own in the end, and I hadn't planned that out at all. She comes in the first page simply because Jonathan needed a colleague to talk to and really just took off all by herself. So yes, I plot, but then I don't necessarily stick to it.
Maybe it's Kelly's youth, but she actually provides quite a lot of energy.
I hope so. She was hard to write as well because, you know, I've been living in France now for several years and don't really have any contact with sort of the youth of today. So, again, my writing buddy gave me some of the expressions that her daughter-in-law used so that I could attribute them to Kelly, because I didn't want her to sound the same as Melissa, who's a 40-something-year-old woman who would probably speak much the same way as I do. But Kelly was going to have a voice of her own.
I was astounded to find that you live in France and that you're not actually originally from Bristol. The book has a really Bristolian voice, which is very much helped by the choice of two Bristolian narrators to read the audiobook.
Definitely. I think they did a terrific job. I don't really get any choice in who narrates the book, but in this particular instance, my editor sent me samples of the two voice actors who are going to narrate my book. And you can hear the Bristol accent, and I thought that was just absolutely perfect. So Charlie Sanderson does both women in the book, and Philip does the male voice, and I think they go very well together. I was very, very pleased with the outcome. So I know Bristol fairly well. My mother went to university there, so we visited it a lot when I was younger. I've done swimming competitions there and we visited it then. And also, when I'm planning a book, either I drag my family on holiday to the place where I want to set the book, or I bring over my school kids because I'm a school teacher, and then profit from that to go on field trips and research where I want to go. And then in the meantime, it's a lot of internet and Google Maps and so on. But you can't get a feel for the place, I don't think, unless you've actually set foot there. But I like Bristol very much. Probably the setting was least important in this particular book. It's very important in the two previous books, and particularly the second book, where Caitlin Best, the heroine, comes from Somerset and moves to the Lake District, which is just the most wonderful place in the world, and I'd love to live there. But she can't fit in there. She doesn't manage to fit into her surroundings at all, and she lives with her new husband in a house which is horrifically ugly and quite gothic looking in the middle of these beautiful surroundings. So setting was extremely important there. I think it's almost a character, really, the setting. You have to choose carefully where you want to set your book.
Now, all three of your novels so far have been standalone. Without offering any spoilers, not everything gets tied up at the end of The Guilty Mother. Is there a possibility of a series?
A few people have asked me if I would, so maybe one day. I'm still thinking it is Kelly's backstory that's not completely resolved, and I still think, right, what could I do with that? So I've got another two books in my head at the moment, one of which I'm writing, and then I would like to get on with the one after that, but I may well come back to it. I like to leave it a little bit open-ended, although equally some readers aren't very happy with that and feel that it's not finished off correctly. But I remember when I was younger and reading, and open-ended books meant that I was able to make up my own ending to the books, and I quite liked that, so I tend to leave a question in there that's not answered.
I like to mull over a book for a couple of weeks after I've finished reading it. And I always think if you get all the answers tied up nicely with a ribbon at the end, you're far less likely to do so.
Yes, I agree.
Before we came in and did the interview, you were telling me that you actually have a retirement plan for if you ever stop writing.
I do, or if I could stop teaching and perhaps write and do this as well. I would very much like to be involved with training up guide dogs. I'm Labrador mad. I have a Labrador called Cookie, who's another of my writing buddies. She keeps my feet warm and doesn't look at me strangely when I talk to my characters aloud while I'm walking her. And I'd like to be involved with training up guide dogs, but it's very time consuming. You have to take them to all their training sessions, and I think it's probably very heartbreaking because you have to give them up after they become two, when they're no longer puppies. But it is something I'd like to be involved in. There's a centre near to where I live, and I know people who do it, and I admire them greatly for it.
So there is a guide dog association in France, rather like our own then?
I presume it works similarly to the one in England, yes. And there's an actual centre for Labradors near to us, yeah.
Well, Diane Jeffrey, thank you so much for coming into the studio and being a guest on Read On, and I very much look forward to inviting you back for novels 4, 5 and beyond.
Oh, that would be amazing. Thank you very much for having me.
As I pull up at the bus stop a few feet away from the entrance to Kingswood Secondary School, Nora hands over the toy. Then he leaps out of the car and strolls away without so much as a goodbye. I drive around the corner to the junior school, stopping on the yellow zigzag lines. I flick my hazards on. Alfie and I get out of the car. "I'll come in and apologize to your teacher," I say, grabbing Alfie's bag from the passenger seat. "I can go in by myself," he says, slamming his door shut and peering up at me through his mother's chocolate eyes. Invisible fingers pinch my heart. "I know you can, but we're late and Dad's never come in." The way he says it implies it's only mums who do, and now the hand gives my heart a hard squeeze. "Anyway, she knows you have a problem with punctuality. She's used to it," he adds. "Plus, if you park there," he points an accusatory finger at my Ford Focus, "you'll get another fine." I can't believe I'm hearing my 9-year-old son correctly. I ruffle his hair and hand over his bag before getting back in behind the wheel. A wave of sadness breaks over me as he turns away. He reminds me so much of his mother. Too much.
The Guilty Mother, narrated by Charlie Sanderson and Philip Stevens, is TB704784. And Diane will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Lynn Livingston introduces us to the new books in the library for Christmas, and we find out some fun facts about that Yuletide icon, the Robin. But first, with over 120 talking books to his name, John Cormack will be a familiar voice to many listeners. His range is enormous, from hard-edged thrillers to stories for young children, taking in autobiography, poetry and fantasy along the way. Keen to find out what he's currently working on, I caught up with him during a break in recording at the RNIB Camden Studios. John Cormack, welcome to the Read On Studio.
Great to be here.
So what are you working on in the Talking Book Studio?
At the moment, I'm recording a Northern Irish crime novel by a writer I've recorded some of his work before called Adrian McKinty. And they're set in Belfast in the 80s, and they're quite irreverent, full of black humour, lots of Northern Irish characters, which I quite like doing. So that's quite fun. So I'm having a ball with it, actually. Yeah, it's lovely. Comes off the page really well.
You've done quite a lot of thrillers. I was looking through the 120 books that you've recorded.
I had no idea. Is it really that? Oh, Lord, man and boy.
Well, I just presume you're keeping very busy, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
But yeah, you've done quite a lot of thrillers. I notice actually there are some of the great horse racing authors there. John Frankham, bit of Dick Francis.
I like to do good literature, yeah. Yes, no, well, actually, the horse racing thing was quite nice because my dad, my dear departed dad, was a big racing fan, and I live near Newmarket, which he used to call headquarters, so I used to go racing with Dad, so I have a little bit of racing knowledge. I never make any money, but you know.
And you recorded the Willie Carson autobiography as well.
I did.
Was that fun?
I have very little memory of it. A lot of it was Willie, without being libelous, Willie's ego is quite large. Larger than he is.
He is a jockey.
I know. No, completely. That's kind of, it's prerequisite for the job, isn't it? I know. Yeah.
But yeah, and you've recorded an awful lot of sporting autobiographies. I noticed George Best was in there, Good, the Bad and the Bubbly.
That's right. Yeah, poor old Georgie. Georgie was my, a lot of those books are quite badly written, let's face it. But George Best was, I'm of an age where George Best was my hero. And I wanted to be George Best, and I was so lucky when I was 12, my dad brought me to London, and I saw George Best play. And they played against West Ham, and he scored 2 goals and got a standing ovation from the West Ham fans. And that has always stuck in my mind. It's a pivotal thing for me. And then poor old Georgie's self-destruction, So, but the Good, the Bad and the Bubbly was, it was bubbly.
He had an amazing life.
Bless him, extraordinary. But, this huge talent, but he just couldn't cope with it. And also being the first, the fifth Beatle, he was christened. Mm. Footballers were just guys who went on the bus with you in those days, and suddenly this adoration, and bless him, he couldn't cope. But yeah. He was some footballer.
I noticed Alex Higgins' autobiography was there as well.
You've really been doing your research, haven't you? That was really, I was actually quite sad, because all through it, he is bitter. That wasn't my fault. this happened, someone else did this, I didn't hit her, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. And again, you know, a genius on the snooker table, but a mess otherwise as a human being. And you just have to read it and think, oh Lord, and feel sorry for him, really. But it was a great sense of bitterness through the whole thing.
Coming back to the football, one series I saw you recorded that looked great fun was Dino FC.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was great. I did those. I don't have kids, so I didn't know. My knowledge of kids' books is rubbish, really. And I really enjoyed that, really enjoyed those. And the nice thing is when you're doing dinosaurs, you can do any voice you like, and you can make up the voices for the dinosaurs. And that was great fun. And I really enjoy, I love doing kids' books. I've done quite a few kids' books. I can't think of the names of any now, but there was quite a few there.
There was Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think, is in there,
yeah,
isn't
possibly,
it?
Yeah, that's there. And there was one I did, and I can't remember the name of it, but the Tooth Fairy is in it. But the Tooth Fairy is not this nice person who leaves whatever it is these days, a pound under your pillow. The Tooth Fairy is actually a skinhead thug who steals teeth and sells them on the black market. And he's wearing a tutu, and he comes and gets all your teeth at night.
And he talks a bit like that.
And I had great fun with him. I loved him.
Do you have a preferred genre that you like reading?
Yeah, I think books that have a lot of dialogue. Because being an actor, first and foremost, you know, dialogue is my bread and butter. So Roddy Doyle comes to mind with that. And Roddy Doyle started as a playwright. So, in fact, the dialogue in his books lift off the page beautifully. And I've done all the Barrytown trilogies. They're in the library somewhere. And various other Roddy Doyle books. And I love doing Roddy Doyle stuff. Funny story about Roddy Doyle, though. My mum was partially sighted near the end of her life. And she used to get audiobooks. And she ended up, of course, getting mine. But I used to get critiques on the phone, and I would get, I don't like that Roddy Doyle, there's a lot of swearing in that. And I said, Mum, you better talk to Roddy Doyle, I'm just doing the book, you know.
How did you get into becoming a narrator?
Bizarrely, I met another narrator. People might know his books, an American reader called William DeVries, Bill DeVries. I met Bill at a wedding. I had just left drama school, and we got chatting, and probably had too much champagne. And Bill said, hey, you've got a nice voice. You should go to the RNIB and read books. And that's I fell into it that way.
Wow. And as you say, I mean, you've covered an enormous range of books. Some of the best Irish literature of the last 25 years. Frank McCourt, yeah. Angela's Ashes.
Fantastic, yeah. And I'm from Limerick as well, so Angela's Ashes was very poignant and pertinent. Yeah, yeah.
And Patrick McCabe as well.
Oh, I was thinking about that today, The Butcher Boy. He's just written a new book, actually. I saw a review in the paper, and I can't remember what it's called. I normally, when I do audiobooks, I do a lot of preparation on them beforehand. So I'm reading them beforehand, I'm marking them up, I'm doing all that. When we did The Butcher Boy, it was such a shocking... It shocked me on every page. I said to whoever was producing it at the time, so way back in the old days in Great Portland Street, can we just do this cold? I won't even read it beforehand and let it shock. So we tried an experiment and did it that way. And I think it worked because it brought the freshness to... Because it's about a psychopath who's killing people all the time. And it was really, truly shocking. Glad you brought that one up because I really enjoyed doing it. It's a long time ago now. My voice is much younger then, I think.
Is there a book out there that you dream of narrating?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, probably. I mean, this is very personal. A book that was very big for me growing up was The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat. I'm not the right voice for it, so I would never get to do it. And I'm sure somebody august like the late Stephen Thorne or somebody has done it. You know, I don't know. I'm guessing. But it just always stuck in my head. And also with the film with Jack Hawkins and all that stuff. So I mean, it sounds a weird choice, but I just love that book. Yeah.
You mentioned Stephen Thorne and the other narrators, and I'm always struck when I walk past the green room that there's a lovely atmosphere coming out of there, and you're all swapping stories, and you've clearly known each other for a long time. I also noticed that quite a few of you have rituals or little tricks of the trade. Are you one of those people who sort of waltz three times Widdershins round the little coffee table, or eats a banana before you go in. And
banana is vital, because then it stops your tummy rumbling, because once tummy's rumbling, you can't do anything about it. I take my shoes off in studio, and I work in my stocking feet, as they used to call it, all the time. I'm just more comfortable like that. I don't know why I do that. Maybe it might have come from one day I had wet shoes from a wet day. I have no idea. But yeah, there's lovely atmosphere among all the... Because all the narrators, readers, whatever you call us, we've all been knocking around. Well, a lot of us have been knocking around quite a bit. And we meet in green rooms, both here and in commercial studios quite a bit. So we know each other. And because it's... Each voice is so particular to the book, the way the casting is done, there isn't a sort of a jealousy about, oh, I really wanted to do that book, or I wanted to... So that's quite nice.
I understand that it's not just audiobooks that you've narrated. You had a rather interesting job during the 1980s, didn't you?
I did, yes. I was the voice of Gerry Adams for Channel 4 News. Oh, it was mad. It was just stupid. I actually got the job through a friend who said, I'm doing the voice of Gerry Adams for Channel 4 News, but I'm going off on tour with a show. Would you like to take over the job? Now, I'm not from Northern Ireland. I'm from Limerick in the south of Ireland, but I can do a passable Northern Irish accent. And I used to pitch up at Channel 4 whenever they wanted me. And Jon Snow would do an interview with Adams. Adams might be in Derry or in Belfast or wherever he was. And I would watch this. And then we would, because of the government ban on terrorists not being heard on TV, they insisted that Adams' voice and other people like Martin McGuinness were voiced by an actor. And I was that actor.
And it started off being lip-synced, and...
Yeah, we used to lip-sync it, and he was really hard to lip-sync because he mumbled, and Jerry was a... and he had a big beard. And then there were questions in the House, apparently. Channel 4 bosses were brought into one of those subcommittees you see on the TV, saying, we don't believe it's an actor, we think it's Adams.
Just so, too convincing.
Well, there you go. I mean, it's quite a compliment, I suppose, in one sense. So what they decided to do then was that they would run my voice ahead of the lip sync, if you like. So, of course, I just, anytime I met voiceover friends, they just said, you're not doing that very well, you're not in sync. But that was the way Channel 4 agreed to get over this worry that it might be Adams. It was a silly time, and... But it was very lucrative, so that was fine. And then it stopped, and then I went back to being poor again. You know, so.
But I suppose in some ways it comes full circle, because you're doing a Northern Irish accent now in the Talking Book Studios
completely.
For the Adrian McKinty books.
Adrian McKinty books, yeah, completely. Yeah, so there we are.
Well, thank you ever so much, John Cormack, for giving up your lunch hour to come in and talk
Not
to us at Read On. And I will be listening out for the new Sean Duffy.
Sean Duffy is the hero, that's right.
Thank you very much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you, Red.
She met Malachy at a party given by Dan McAdorney and his wife Minnie on Klassen Avenue in Brooklyn. Malachy liked Angela, and she liked him. He had a hangdog look, which came from the 3 months he had just spent in jail for hijacking a truck. He and his friend, John McAlane, believed what they were told in the speakeasy, that the truck was packed to the roof with cases of canned pork and beans. Neither knew how to drive, and when the police saw the truck lurch and jerk along Myrtle Avenue, they pulled it over. The police searched the truck, and wondered why anyone would hijack a truck containing not pork and beans, but cases of buttons.
My guest, John Cormack, narrating Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt, which is TB11434. For a full list of the wide range of titles that John has narrated, search the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. You're listening to the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, some fascinating facts about Britain's favourite bird. And Diane Jeffrey picks the books of her life. But before that, each week in the run-up to Christmas, Read On is opening a box of Yuletide treats. And who better to get us started than Lynn Livingston? Here she is with some great titles from the RNIB library to curl up with.
We have quite a few new Christmas talking books in the library this year, and if your perfect Christmas movie is one of those Hallmark movies you find on Channel 5, then you're going to love these cozy romances. You can spend Christmas at the Log Cabin by Catherine Ferguson. You can have A Perfect Cornish Christmas by Philippa Ashley, which may even lead to A Wedding in December by Sarah Morgan. You can treat yourself to Christmas at Rachel's Pudding Pantry by Caroline Roberts, or even Christmas at the Comfort Food Cafe by Debbie Johnson. There's even a couple of Mills and Boone titles, Coming Home for Christmas by Rhiann Fain and I'll Be Home for Christmas, which is by Strictly Come Dancing winner Abby Clancy.
Daniel Wells is my real hero. He's Han Solo and Jack Bauer and Barack Obama all rolled into one. He doesn't look or act like any of those people. I'm just trying to convey how brilliant he is. To me, at least. Daniel and I have known each other since we were toddlers. He used to live next door to us on our quiet terrace street in Liverpool. And there are, I believe, photos still in existence of us playing with rubber ducks in the bath together when we were two. We still sometimes take a bath together, but things tend to end differently these days.
Continuing the theme of books with songs for titles, we have Let It Snow by Sue Moorcroft and Rewrite the Stars by Emma Hetherington. You're sure to find love before the last page of all of these books.
Roma sat down and wrapped her arms around her, smelling of fresh air and compost. Oh, if you only knew the hours we talked about it. Everything, anything I thought of doing just felt as if it would make my wrong wronger, risk my family and risk his family. If we told you the truth and you wanted to find him, it would change the entire dynamic of our family. You and Zinnia, Patsy and me. Lily, don't hate me. You had two mothers and a sister. I wanted it to be enough. So, on my behalf, you chose to exclude me from his family. One half of my family. Lily propped her head on her fist. She could actually see how her mother had made the choice she had, though it left her feeling as if she had a black hole where her insides should be.
We also have some new family sagas, which are in existing series. If you love a bit of Corrie, we can whisk you back to the days of Elsie Tanner and Annie Walker with Snow on the Cobbles by Maggie Sullivan. This is the third book in the Coronation Street series. We also have the third book in the District Nurses series by Annie Groves, Christmas for the District Nurses. And another Woolworth Girls book with Christmas at Woolworth by Elaine Everett.
Hilda Ogden blew the dust off the photograph frame.
My Stan,
she sighed. She pursed her lips in the direction of his cheek, only drawing back when they touched the cold glass. Come home soon, Chuck, she whispered, as she placed it back on the tiled mantelpiece. The bed's cold without you. But she had no time to dwell on her prisoner of war husband right now. While he remained stuck in Italy, there wasn't much he could do to help her. But here at home, it was Monday morning, the start of a new working week. Time for Hilda to brave the spell of wintry weather that had suddenly hit Weatherfield, and hope that the thin dusting of snow that had already stuck to the wet cobbles overnight wouldn't seep through the canvas of her shoes. It was time for her to venture out to find a new job.
If you like sagas more historical, we have the new Dilly Court, The Christmas Wedding, which is set in Victorian times. And for something completely different, we have a collection of Christmas short stories and poems by Agatha Christie called Star Over Bethlehem. These are very different from the usual mystery stories written by Christie. There's not a detective in sight. And for our children, or those who are just young at heart, we have three new Christmas tales. A Tree for Christmas is a Winnie the Pooh story for our youngest listeners. The Polar Express by Chris Van Allsburg and Miracle on 34th Street by Valentine Davis are the book versions of two of our favourite Christmas films. I hope there's something there to bring you a bit of festive cheer. Merry Christmas from the team at RNIB Library.
Thanks, Lynn. Read On will feature more about some of those books in the run-up to Christmas. And if you have a favourite festive title that you like to enjoy with a mince pie, why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And while we're on the subject of sharing, to donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text SANTA to 70456. Texts are charged at £5 plus one standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support that they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio.
To donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text SANTA to 70456. Texts are charged at £5 plus one standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, before Diane Jeffrey shares the books of her life, and continuing with the festive theme, Stephen Moss is a naturalist and author. The Robin, a biography, reveals some interesting facts about Britain's favourite bird. He joined me down the line from Bath Spa University to tell me more. So, Stephen Moss, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red.
So the book's full of fascinating facts about the robin. For instance, I never realised that the name Robin is actually a nickname.
Yes, I think that's one of the oddest things. I'm actually writing a book at the moment about bird names, and that's one of the things that came up when I was doing the research for that, which is that when, for example, my grandmother was bringing me up, she used to talk about Jenny Wren, Robin Redbreast, Tom Tit, you know, little nicknames for birds. And it was only later that it occurred to me that it's a bit like as if we were calling all wrens a Jenny, because Robin is actually the nickname. Redbreast was the original name. And in fact, there's a name even older than that, Ruddock, which means red little bird, a bit like Dunnock for brown little bird. So, yeah, Robin is basically a nickname.
And, of course, the robin doesn't have a particularly red breast. It's more orange, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I have to say, my wife disagrees with this. She said, well, of course it's red, but we do see colours differently, all of us. But to me, it's orange-red or reddish-orange. And, of course, the reason for this, it's not called robin orange breast, apart from the fact it's not alliterative and doesn't really scan. The main reason is that when the robin was called red breast back in the 13th, 14th century and possibly even earlier, the colour orange didn't actually exist in the sense that it was considered a shade of red. It was only when oranges began to be imported from southern Europe into Britain in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries that people started adopting the name orange, which was the name of the fruit, for the colour that we now know as orange.
Ah, right, OK. So it's as recent as that.
Yeah, so it's a bit like, you know, it's like light green and light blue don't really have their own names, do they? But orange does, but it's really a sort of pale red.
And where did the link between the robin and Christmas come from?
I think there's two reasons for this. The obvious reason is that robins are very tame in winter. Robins are largely insectivorous birds. So they eat insects, they eat invertebrates, mostly from the soil or the grass. So you see them hopping around your lawn or your flower bed. And in winter, particularly in the old days when there was a lot of ice and snow in winter just coming up to Christmas, which there isn't much now, but robins would come to the back doorstep looking for food, and people would give food, perhaps scraps of bread or a little bit of lard or something to them. And so they became associated with that season. And of course, they are a bird that's around in our gardens in winter. Then what happened was when the first penny post started in 1840, the first postmen wore red uniforms and were nicknamed robins. And someone had the bright idea of putting a picture of a robin on a card and marketing it as a Christmas card. This was a new thing because, of course, before then you couldn't post cards, so people didn't really give cards to each other. So robins were put on Christmas cards, and they often had a little letter in their beak, and the idea was they were representing the postman.
And other, I mean, the book brims over with fascinating facts. It's a real, well, it's a magpie's delight as far as, but the other fact I hadn't realised is just how British this love of robins is, and that's closely linked to us not having wild boars in our woods.
That's right. Yeah, we do now, of course, in a few woods like the Forest of Dean and the Ashdown Forest, we've got wild boars. But for over 500 years, there were no wild boars in Britain. Now, if you go to the continent and you talk to people there, they see robins. I've seen robins in Spain and France, but they're usually in woods. They're not normally, well, they don't have as many gardens as us, but they're a bird of woodland. They're quite a shy bird. And in ancient times, and still now in places like France, robins would follow wild boars around because, as you know, wild boars dig up the soil with those fearsome tusks, and they're always turning over earth in forests. And of course, that allows the robin to find food. Now, when robins are in Britain, they don't have wild boars, so they started following us around, and particularly probably 100 or so years ago when gardening started to become very popular. You'd find that when you were digging up the soil, a robin would turn up next to you, and you think, oh, isn't that lovely? What a lovely little bird. It's so affectionate and friendly. Well, it is, but it's only affectionate and friendly. It's what, again, my mum would have called cupboard love. It basically wants the food you're unearthing. So you turn over the soil, it nips down and grabs a worm, sits on your spade, everyone's happy. But actually, it's exploiting us.
And obviously very successfully, because you say there are 6 million mating pairs within the UK?
Yes, roughly. It's always hard to estimate, but that's the general estimate. And that makes it Britain's second commonest bird. Now, can you guess? Well, you've probably read the book, but I bet if I'd asked you before you read the book, you wouldn't know what our commonest bird is.
I believe it's the wren, isn't it?
It is the wren, yeah, with about 10 million pairs in Britain and Ireland, probably about 8 million in Britain. Now, people never believe that.
And yet I wouldn't recognise, well, I can't see, but I wouldn't have recognised a wren when I could see, and yet a robin is instantly recognisable to us all.
Yes, what you would recognise of the wren is its song, mm-hmm. of course. The wren has this wonderfully loud song. It's probably the loudest song of any tiny British bird. It's a very small bird, only weighs about 8-10 grams, which is about, you know, third of an ounce. And yet it has incredibly loud song with what my friend Dominic Cousins, a fellow nature writer, calls the twiddle in the middle. And he always says that a wren reminds him of an opera diva giving her all in the last act, because they really do sing very loudly and with great energy. So if you hear that song, listen to that song, and you'll hear that all over the place, even around now, even in winter you hear them.
You mentioned how small the wren is, but the robin isn't much bigger. You said roughly the same weight as two new £1 coins.
Yeah, I think it's about 12 grams, a robin, 12, 15 grams. It's not very big. You know, you get quite a few for a quarter of sweets. So, yeah, it's a pretty small bird, but all songbirds are. You know, they're small and light because they need to fly. A mammal of the same size would be 3 or 4 times the weight, because, of course, it doesn't need to get airborne. So it's like all small birds, robins have very delicate wings, hollow bones, you know, so they're able to get airborne.
One of the great pleasures throughout the year is hearing robins, usually in my case, singing on lampposts. They're fiercely territorial, and what I hadn't realised is that both male and female robins are territorial and both sing.
Yes, that's very unusual. Amongst British birds, the robin's really the only bird where the female regularly holds territory and sings. All the others, it's the male bird singing. And the other unusual thing about robins is they hold territory, different territories sometimes, smaller ones, but they hold them all year round. So the male and female, the male will hold the territory in the spring and summer, the female will breed with him, and then in autumn they will split up, and she will sometimes actually fly all the way over to France or Spain, or she may just fly a little bit further away, and she will find a small territory and she will defend it by singing. And it's probably all about food. Most things in nature are about food. But that means that you do hear robins throughout the year. You also, as you mentioned, hear them at night. Now, this is, again, for two reasons. One is robins have taken very well to cities and towns where there are streetlights, but they also have very good sight. They have these big black eyes, beady eyes, and that means that they are able to see earlier in the morning and later at night than other birds. So you often hear a robin first thing in the dawn chorus. But what also happens is robins get woken up at night by The streetlights come on, the robin's woken up, it starts singing. And next door, because their territories are so tiny in cities, the next male robin starts singing. And it's a bit like a sort of arms race or you know, a set of dominoes. Once one starts singing, the other one can't resist because he's worried about defending his territory. And so, of course, you do get robins singing at night, and people then think they're nightingales because, of course, as you know, the nightingale's the only bird that sings at night, except it isn't.
But they are the same family.
They are, yes. Yeah, they are. Robins are funny. They're the only bird now in their genus. There's lots of birds around the world called robin or robin chat, lots of birds with robin in their name. Some of them are closely related. Distantly related to robins, they're chats, as we call them, like little miniature thrushes. But an awful lot of them aren't. The one in America, the American robin, is basically a big beefy thrush, a bit like very closely related to our blackbird, but with a sort of orangey, rusty breast. And basically, the Pilgrim Fathers went over there, someone was homesick, they saw a bird with a reddish breast, called it a robin.
So is this love of the robin only a British and expat thing, or would you find robins being as popular in China or Asia or whatever?
Not at all. No, culturally, it's a very British thing. The Americans love their robin. In fact, recently they decided in America to change all the names of all the birds called robin to thrush, because they are all thrushes. And the one they wouldn't change was American robin, because they felt that with the cultural associations, you know, Michael Jackson's song Rockin' Robin, or the old song, When the Rob Rob Robin Comes Bob Bob Bobbing Along. And that's, you know, they love their robins as well, but it's a different species. So no, our robin, if you go to the continent, people know it and they like it, but it's no different from perhaps a stone chat or a black red start or a red start or these other very beautiful birds in that family. But it's not considered culturally special as our robin is.
You're obviously a very keen ornithologist. Or birdwatcher? I don't know.
Birdwatcher. I suppose I am an ornithologist. I'm not a trained ornithologist because I'm not a scientist. And to be honest, I'm equally interested in the cultural side of birds. So the robin, a biography, as we called it, is actually, I suppose, half of it is science and my own observations, and the other half is the culture of robins, because I just find that side of birds endlessly fascinating.
And robins have a habit of making nests in some very bizarre places.
Yeah, I think of all birds, they're probably the weirdest in terms of that. I mean, they nest in broad, mostly they'll nest in sort of shrubbery, hedgerows, things like honeysuckle, clematis. You know, they'll find a little area and build a little open nest out of grass and moss and lay their eggs in. And it has to be hidden away, but they'll also nest in almost any crevice, so outside toilets, on top of a cistern, in sheds, in pillar boxes, in people's coat pockets, in a famously in an unmade bed, in the engine of a plane, in the engine of a Land Rover. You know, they're just looking for a safe place to lay their eggs. You know, that's what's funny about robins. We put all this sort of culture on top of them, so mostly benevolent and some not. But of course, they're just doing what birds do. They're trying to raise a family and they're doing it quickly. Robins live fast and die young, probably only live a year or two mostly. So many of them die before their first birthday, so they have to get going. So they're really just doing what birds do, but we've associated this with so many aspects of our own lives.
The way you describe the robin, its opportunism, the way it cocks its head when it looks at you whilst you're gardening, whilst it's waiting for its worms. I mean, in many ways, and the fact that it can also be very aggressive, but also very friendly seeming, it does seem to have some rather human traits. Do you think that's why we in Britain have taken it quite so close to our hearts, that we see ourselves in the bird?
I think so. I think that's often the case. Having said that, of course, two groups of birds that have very human traits in that they're very clever, they are very opportunistic, are crows and gulls. And we tend to not like crows and gulls, and we particularly don't like them when they move into our territory, so gulls in cities. So I think with the robin, it looks undeniably extremely cute. Those big eyes, the big round head, the plump breast, the red. Male and females, of course, both have a red breast. And even though the red breast is actually a signal of aggression, to us it's a symbol of beauty. So I think really it's that. I don't think it's just because... I think it's because they live alongside us rather than being particularly like us. We got a new Labrador puppy about 4 or 5 months ago called Rosie, and she's a beautiful red fox Labrador, rather almost like an orange robin-y colour, actually, bit lighter. And One day I was sitting in my office, as I am now, out in the Somerset countryside in my garden, and I had the door open because it was the summer, so this was back in June, July, and suddenly this little bird rushed in, being chased by a very frantic and barking Rosie. And it was a baby robin. It was must have been July, because it was just molting. I just had the beginnings of the red breast on the speckled plumage. And luckily, I grabbed it very quickly and very carefully and took it down the garden and released it over the hedge. And it was very happy, because Rosie probably would have made short work of it, because she's quite curious about things like that. That was my sort of embarrassing story. I don't think the others are mostly in the book. There's an awful lot of stuff, as you say, in the book. It was a delight to write. I'm hoping to do the Wren next. You never know if the publishers are listening. And we're hoping, you've asked about an audio book. I've done audio books before. For the two books I did with my friend Brett Westwood, we did Tweet of the Day and we did Wonderland, and they're both available on audio book. And they usually tend to be a bit of an afterthought, sadly, and they're done, you know, after the book's out. So I promise you, I am lobbying for an audiobook of The Robin, partly because it's a lovely short book, so I better read it in a day, but partly because I think people would really enjoy it, and it would be lovely for your listeners to be able to hear it read by my dulcet tones, hopefully.
In the meantime, I've been enjoying it read by my wife and my daughters, both of whom are rather impressed by the feisty female Robins.
Absolutely. Quite right.
I also, I understand from them that the illustrations and especially the cover art is absolutely beautiful. So I'm sure it'll be finding its way into many a Christmas stocking.
I do hope so. Yeah, it was a lovely book to write. It's always lovely when people have read a book I've written and say to me, well, someone said to me a few years ago, a woman came up and she said, oh, I loved your book. She said, but it was very easy to read. And then she stopped herself and said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not the right thing at all to say to a proper nature writer. And I said, it's a lovely thing to say. Thank you so much. Because, of course, I want it to be easy to read. But the Robin book's very easy to read, you know. I promise you, there's not a lot of heavy science, bit of feminism, as you say, with the feisty females, and, you know, hopefully something for everyone.
Stephen Moss's book, The Robin, A Biography, is out now in print and ebook, and it's flying off the shelves. I'm sure it'll be found nesting under many a tree this Christmas. Now it's back to Diane Jeffrey for the books of her life. Diane, was there a book that you read as a child or a very young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit and say that there was an author who made me want to become a writer, Enid Blyton. I read all of her books, The Secret Seven, The Famous Five. I thought Enid Blyton was amazing. I didn't just want to be an author, I actually wanted to be Enid Blyton. And at school, I wouldn't read anything else. So by the time I got to, I don't know, something like the age of seven, the teacher called in my mother and said, no, she really needs to be reading something else. So they tried to widen my reading a little bit, but Enid Blyton was always my big influence, I think.
One fine day, right at the beginning of the Easter holidays, four children and a dog travelled by train together. Soon be there now, said Julian, a tall, strong boy with a determined face. Roof, said Timothy the dog, getting excited and trying to look out of the window too. Get down, Tim, said Julian. Let Anne have a look. Anne was his younger sister. She put her head out of the window. We're coming into Kirin Station, she said. I do hope Aunt Fanny will be there to meet us. Of course she will, said Georgina, her cousin. She looked more like a boy than a girl, for she wore her hair very short, and it curled close about her head. She too had a determined face, like Julian. She pushed Anne away and looked out of the window. It's nice to be going home, she said. I love school, but it will be fun to be at Kirin Cottage, and perhaps sail out to Kirin Island and visit the castle there. We haven't been since last summer.
The RNIB Library has a huge selection of books by Enid Blyton, including this version of Five Go to Smuggler's Top, read by Jan Francis, which is TB 17083. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
One of the books I've read in recent years that I absolutely adored, which is completely out of my genre, is The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared by Jonas, and I'm not sure if I've pronounced that correctly. He's a Swedish writer, and I found the book so funny, and I was actually invigilating for exams in France while I was reading this book, invigilating would be more accurate, and laughed my way through their exam. I thought it was absolutely hilarious, and it's very clever because the 100 years span an entire century, and so you get all the historic events that he's lived through in his lifetime through that book. And I haven't actually dared read anything else by the author because I love this book so much. I'm a little bit scared that the rest won't quite meet up to it.
When Chief Inspector Aronsson reported his findings to Prosecutor Conny Ranelid in Eskilstuna, the prosecutor immediately decided to issue a warrant for the arrest of Allan Karlsson, Julius Jonsson, Benny Ljungberg and Gunilla Björklund. Aronsson and the prosecutor in charge of the case had been in close touch ever since the centenarian climbed out of the window and disappeared, and the prosecutor's interest had continued to grow. Now he was reflecting upon the spectacular possibility of getting Allan Karlsson convicted for murder, or at least manslaughter, even though they hadn't found any victims. There were one or two cases in Swedish legal history that showed it could be done, but you needed exceptionally good evidence and an extremely skillful prosecutor.
The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared by Jonas Jonasson is available in Braille and as TB 20097, narrated by Leighton Pugh. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
This is really a difficult question to answer. My current read is The Chain. I've been reading that in the tube while I've been over here in London. The Chain by Adrian McKinty, which I think has a particularly original premise. A woman's daughter is kidnapped, and in order to get her daughter back, not only does she have to pay the ransom, but she also has to kidnap somebody else's child. And it's really nerve-wracking. It's a very addictive read.
Thursday, 7:55 a.m. She's sitting at the bus stop checking the likes on her Instagram feed and doesn't even notice the man with the gun until he's almost next to her. She could have dropped her school bag and run across the marshes. She's a nimble 13-year-old, and she knows all the swamps and quicksands of Plum Island. There's a little morning sea fog, and the man is big and clumsy. He'd be nervous about pursuit, and he'd certainly have to give up the chase before the school bus came at 8 o'clock. All this goes through her head in a second. The man is now standing right in front of her. He's wearing a black ski mask and pointing the gun at her chest. She gasps and drops her phone.
The Chain by Adrian McKinty is available commercially in print, ebook and audio, which is narrated by January Lavoie. Well, Diane Jeffrey, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
And thank you again for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.